Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Yeah, she pretty good. She subconsciously mocks that lineage. But she's
so that's happening? Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. John Ridley is a man of immense writing talents. As a writer, as a producer, and a director, he has credits going all the way back to The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and later the film Three Kings. He's got half a dozen novels under his belt. He's written graphic novels, a play. He's busy all the time. But since 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote, John Ridley has emerged as one of Hollywood's strongest voices on issues of race. In the past few months, he came out with Guerrilla, a fictional account of a couple in the Black Power movement of the 70s, and Let It Fall, a documentary about the Rodney King verdict. John Ridley and I spoke earlier this month, shortly after the president began talking about Charlottesville. I can't help but charge right into the politics. We will get to so many subjects, but we are now at a moment where we're just days away from the president of the United States failing to distinguish between neo-Nazis and white supremacists and their opponents. And I've got to ask you, are you surprised? Are you the opposite of surprised?
I'm stunned, because I'm not surprised that politicians use race for advantage or to separate us or to try to further their objectives. But we have gotten to a space where it had been euphemisms, it had been dog whistle, it had been light nods or the Southern strategy or things like that. But at this time, to first take a measure in coming up with some response, then take 48 hours to come up with what in 2017 to the majority of the people was the correct response. And then after 24 hours of reflection to say, you know what, there is this sliver of discord, there is this sliver of hatred, that's what I need to embrace. I don't understand that part of it.
But you use the word sliver as if it's a tiny, tiny portion of the United States that he's appealing to. Is it so tiny?
I believe it is. I really, really do. I mean, this is, again, we can never minimize, you know, hatred. It only takes one person, as we saw on that weekend, that there were a lot of people who were out there who were ready for violence, but it only took one person, you know, to put their foot on the pedal to actually cause the mayhem that cost a young woman her life, that has injured other people who are still in some degree of recovery. But, you know, you look at the Red Summer way back in the day, where there were masses of individuals who were filled with bigotry who poured through cities and killed and slaughtered, and no one would stand up against it. When the Klan could march freely down, I believe it was Pennsylvania Avenue, but some, you know, prominent promenade in Washington, D.C.
In the 20s.
In the 20s. So comparatively, yeah, this is a sliver, you know.
You wrote the script for the great American film about slavery, 12 Years a Slave. And I wonder in that context how you view Trump's remark saying, look, if we're going to take down the statue to Robert E. Lee, what's next, George Washington?
Well, there is. Look, I think that we do a poor job in this country educating ourselves about all aspects of it. And we do need to acknowledge that George Washington was a slave owner, and that people talk about Sally Hemings being Thomas Jefferson's mistress, but she was actually his property. You know, people have tried to bring some romance into it, but the bottom line is she was property. But I do not know how you know, other than elements of history, really equate George Washington and Thomas Jefferson to Jefferson Davis or Robert E. Lee, who wanted to truly tear this country apart. So there is, I think there's an argument for saying we need to educate ourselves on our leaders, all of them, who they were, what they stood for. You know, people talk about Woodrow Wilson and the League of Nations, but not really understand how he reinstated segregation into
would you want Princeton University to take the name off the Woodrow Wilson School? And
you know what? That's a complicated, because I'd be more interested in, I would advocate for reevaluating Woodrow Wilson before Washington, George Washington, who owned slaves at a time when there were any number of individuals who owned slaves. But Woodrow Wilson, at a time when there were moves, not just moves, but we were removing segregation from the federal government, basically reinstated segregation, I would not have a problem with removing Woodrow Wilson's name. Woodrow Wilson, during his lifetime, made active moves to make this country a worse place for people of color.
The ABC American Crime series spent a lot of time exploring where each of its characters were coming from. So how important is this notion of empathetic storytelling in a culture that's so incredibly polarized, whether it has to do with race or so many other issues?
I think it's hugely important. I think we've got to have a sense of empathy for people, not for their necessarily their ideas and the things that they espouse. There was a gentleman on TV the other day who was an ex-neo-Nazi or white supremacist and moved away from that. And you got to believe that within these folks, you got to hope that there is some humanity somewhere that can be reached. Because if not, then are we to believe that we are going to remain in a state of constant conflict? You've got to believe that there is a space where we can hopefully reach these individuals. And
for, you believe in redemption?
The question is human nature a constant? Do we change over time, or do we become more of what we are?
Does a guy in his early 70s who's behaving the way he does as president of the United States have a shot at evolution and change for the better?
I have to believe so, because if I don't, then I have to believe that I'm doomed to not improve, my kids are. So I got to believe that people can change, and nothing would make me happier than this president, again, standing in front of people saying, you know, this is all wrong. Yes, I hope that at 70 years, 80 years, 85 years, but it needs to, you know, what I would hope for more is that it happens in the now, and not that on his 95th birthday, he looks back and goes, hey, I'm saying this now. Well, but it doesn't, it's good.
It doesn't do us any good.
Yeah, but it doesn't do us good in the here and now. You know, I mean, in all honesty, this has crossed a divide. You know, this separates us, you know, who we are as Americans with those who, and I want to be careful as I say this because, you know, intolerance is wrong, but, you know, it's, as Orrin Hatch said, you know, where do we draw the line? If we don't draw the line at Nazis, you know, who are we as Americans?
You've spent a lot of time in Hollywood, a couple of decades now, and I want to get a sense from you if you think that Hollywood is getting any better at depicting the wholeness of the history of black experience in America, current experience of black in America. Where is Hollywood in your view?
Listen, Hollywood has provided every good thing that I have professionally and to a degree personally. And there are folks out there who have supported me and taken a chance on me. I'm saying that there is a lot of good in Hollywood. Now, having said that there's a lot of good in Hollywood.
Is there enough?
I think Hollywood, you know, to this day has done a poor job of really digging into the true history of America and representation, and also being supportive of people like myself, young men and women of color, of differing backgrounds, you know, women. It's still a big deal for someone like Kathryn Bigelow to go out and make a movie that is, you know, not a romantic comedy, but a very hard-hitting film. I'm referring to Detroit. For Wonder Woman, for people to lose their minds on, oh my God, you can make a film with a female protagonist, with a female director, and people will actually show up. You know, I mean, 2017, really, and people go, oh my God, what? We got to make more of these. Hollywood is historically, look, it part of the reason we are here, when I say here, where we are having to remove the iconography of the Confederacy, you know, the lost cause, the romanticizing of the Confederacy was aided and abetted by Hollywood and Birth of a Nation. And they died with their boots on. And, of course, Gone with the Wind, you know, Song of the South. And it wove its way through politics. It wove its way through a lot of spaces, that idea that the Confederacy, there was something noble about it.
I have to say, I remember sitting in the theater and watching 12 Years a Slave in some of these unbelievable whipping scenes and thinking through tears and shock that what was happening there is that you were whipping away, not only depicting a typical punishment of slavery, but whipping away this kind of sugar-coated earlier depiction of slavery in that era.
Yeah, I would say our intention was not to necessarily be a direct antidote and say, okay, well, they did that, so we're doing this. Solomon Northup left a story that is representative of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of stories back in the day. So we didn't go into 12 Years a Slave saying, okay, well, we're going to make this so horrific because it's an antidote to Song of the South. But this was the history that was left by someone who lived through it. And it was, we needed to impart to people that however distressed you may feel coming out of it, we've shown you one story.
What's coming across your desk now? What are you working on?
Well, the things that you will likely see from me next do embrace a certain hopefulness, a sense of unity. I mean, look, the things that I have worked on over the last bunch of years, all of them have dealt with race and politics and people trying to have agency and fighting back. But for me, you know, I absolutely want to work on things right now that the hope is not so aspirational. It is there. It is underscored a little bit more.
John Ridley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Writer and director John Ridley. Stephen Bannon is gone from the White House. But the legacy is clear. Together with Donald Trump, Bannon made hostility toward identity politics and political correctness a pillar of the new Republican Party. But that view is not only to be found on the right. Mark Lilla is a Democrat, a self-described liberal and a Columbia professor of the humanities, who's been saying very much the same thing. As Lilla sees it, activists and identity groups on the left, of color, of sexual orientation, any number of identities, are losing elections for the Democratic Party, at least in part. He elaborates on this phenomenon in a new book called The Once and Future Liberal. I talked with Mark Lilla last week.
There is a quote recently that Steve Bannon, of all people, delivered. The Democrats, the longer they talk about identity politics, I've got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity, and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush the Democrats. And you have said it works for them, it being identity politics. It doesn't work for us. And there seems to be some link, not that I'm saying your politics by any chance are the same as Steve Bannon's, but you're saying a similar thing, aren't you?
I just think it's an objective fact. I mean, he has no reason to lie about this. And the past two generations of our politics, I think, demonstrates exactly that works for their side and it doesn't work for our side for all kinds of reasons. Now, that is not to say that we don't talk about identity. To understand any social problem in this country, you have to understand identity, and we're more aware of that than ever, and that's been a very good thing. But to address those problems with politics, we have to abandon the rhetoric of difference in order to appeal to what we share so that people who don't share this identity somehow can have a stake and feel something that other people are experiencing. To give you an example, I'm not a black motorist. I will never be a black motorist. I don't know what it's like to look in the rearview mirror of a car and see the lights flashing and feel my stomach churn, right? But I am a citizen, and that person is a fellow citizen. And if we can make the case that citizens in this country, that there are citizens in this country who can't just go for a drive without being worried about this, and they won't be equally protected by the law, I think I can make the case to people who aren't black that that's a terrible thing, right? And so I want to frame the issue in terms of basic values and principles that we share in order to establish sympathy and empathy and identification with someone else.
But Mark, what are you asking African-Americans to do? Be a little less specific, a little more polite somehow? You're asking them to be less aggressive in their demand for justice, whether it's on the road or on the street? I'm not quite – this is where I understand the overall yearning for a more generalized rhetoric of us, of liberal values, of civil rights. I'm not sure why you have the disdain you do, the suspicion that you do for a group like Black Lives Matter, that you're saying that they are going about it in all the wrong way, or unless I'm misunderstanding.
Well, I mean, to read the full passage of what I said about Black Lives Matter, I said Black Lives Matter is a textbook example of how not to build solidarity. There's no denying that by publicizing and protesting police mistreatment of African Americans, the movement mobilized supporters and delivered a wake-up call to every American with a conscience. I'm totally on board with that, right?
So what did Black Lives Matter do that you're at best ambivalent about and very critical, really?
Right, and then I say, but there's no denying that the movement's decision to use this treatment to build a general indictment of American society and its law enforcement institutions and to use Mau Mau tactics to put down dissent and demand a confession of sins and public penitence played into the hands of the Republican
right. But Mark, Mau Mau tactics. Are you familiar? Are you?
Of course I remember. What was that confrontation they had with Hillary Clinton, if not that, right? They were shouting down people at various venues. No, those are Mau Mau tactics, sure.
You're comfortable with that phrase?
Sure. I mean, you know, Mau Mau tactics, I'm also thinking of—
No, I remember the opening
of Tom Wolfe, right?
But I also know where Tom Wolfe stands politically, and which is far, much farther than you're saying you are to the right. And so
I'm not to the right, but—
So some of the criticism that's aimed at your book has less to do with the generalized demand for a more common politics and a desire to win than it is for a certain tonal thing. There's a tone to the book that you have been offended by politics on campus in a way that seems outsized. Can you address that? What's been your experience on campus of identity politics that offends you?
Well, to begin with, what leads to my frustration and my tone is that I'm sick of noble defeats. I'm tired of losing. I'm sickened by the fact that Donald Trump is in power right now. And not just that, but that Republicans control two-thirds of our state legislatures, two-thirds of our governorships, 24 states outright. They win two more. They can call a constitutional convention. Mm-hmm. To my mind, that is the biggest threat to every group that Democrats care about. That's the most important threat.
And it's impossible to have both at once. You can't have a winning strategy without maintaining some semblance of a concentration on identity.
Well, when it comes to the distinction I'm trying to make between analyzing a social problem and developing a political program in order to win power, you know, people who are in movement politics fail to see the distinction, I think, because identity politics is maximalizing. That's how you succeed. You see this as the only issue, right? There's a difference between speaking truth to power and seizing power to defend the truth. And those require very different things, right?
Unless I misread your book, you seem to say that in the interest of winning, and politics is about power ultimately, that the Democratic side ought to think about abandoning certain issues, certain kinds of rhetoric in order to win. So, but abandoning certain things like full-throated opposition to bathroom bills will mean that certain people, transgender people, some of the most vulnerable people in our society, will get hurt. How does a party go about sacrificing people on the altar of the general good?
Well, my main point is this, and I want to get this across. We cannot do anything for these groups we care about if we do not hold power. It is just talk. Therefore, our rhetoric in campaigning must be focused on winning so then we can help these people. An election is not about self-expression. It's not a time to display everything we believe about everything. It's a contest. And once you hold power, then you can do the things you want to do. So your rhetoric has to be mobilizing, and it's got to mobilize.
But you can imagine how outraged a transgender person would feel about such a tactic.
Of course, of course. And the situation of transgender people is you know, can be very, very difficult, especially young people who feel trapped in a body, and suicide rates are terrible and homeless rates are terrible. But let's be concrete about this. Transgender people make up less than one half of 1% of the country. There is no electoral group that we're trying to mobilize. That's not to say that we don't want to help them and focus on that when we analyze our problems and when we get into power. But that is not how you seize power in this country, especially in the states we need to win. Look, we have the two coasts. We need to go to the middle of the country. It's a question of vision. And you know, what was extraordinary about Reagan is that up until 1980, the Republican Party had all these warring factions and they didn't have one message. And once Reagan offered this vision of the very simple vision of the country, all of those groups, the differences between those groups became much less important because they all saw themselves in this vision. And that's what has to happen to us. That we need to be able to put forward a vision so that African Americans look at it and say, those are the principles I stand for. And white working class people look at it too, and they aren't thinking so much about their differences.
Mark, you mentioned Joe Biden as somebody who gets it. Joe Biden was probably the clearest and foremost voice for gay marriage in the Obama administration.
Oh, of course, yeah. But how do we get gay marriage? It was not just that there was a fiat from above. On the contrary, is that this change happened socially. It happened in families. It happened at dinner tables when children came out to their parents. Sometimes parents came out to their kids, right? So,
but it also happened because you had people in the streets shouting, we're here, we're queer, which is something that in the book that you say will only get you a pat on the head. Didn't that help get power too? Didn't Stonewall help get power? Civil rights movement helped get power?
Well, Stonewall certainly mobilize people to then focus on particular pieces of legislation and also to mobilize in order to get research and work on AIDS, HIV. But that's, again, just to focus on one particular issue and one particular group. And if each group is just thinking about itself, it's not thinking like a party. Party politics right now has to come first because we cannot help any of these people if we don't get elected. And as long as we think of ourselves as groups and think now, as the Democratic Party is, which has me worried, that now they have to just add another group or shift to another group, which is the white working class, we're not going to get anywhere.
If you look at those movements, though, there are more radical voices and less radical voices. You look at the AIDS activism. Larry Kramer was a radical voice and said things and still says things that make people crazy and it seems extreme and all the rest. But couldn't you argue that it depends on where you are in time? In other words, without a Larry Kramer, without some of the radicals in the civil rights movement or in the women's rights movement, that in fact things might not push forward quite as well or quite as quickly or quite as effectively. But in real time, when you're experiencing those radical voices, and sometimes they say things that are outrageous or ridiculous, the tendency is to be dismissive of them or to find them ridiculous.
Yeah, I see that. But, you know, every time I look at a documentaries say about the civil rights movement or about the African-American experience. And it comes to the 60s, and Stokely Carmichael comes on. I'd follow him anywhere.
I mean, because of what he's saying or because of his magnetism?
His magnetism and his willingness to call a problem what it is and to not beat around the bush. He was extraordinary. And so when you see a clip of him next to Dr. King, King pales, right? Do I think that Stokely Carmichael and the groups he represented did anything to help persuade white America about race? I don't think so. And I think Dr. King did. Though the appeal for me, just given my personality,
A lot of white kids went down south to follow Stokely Carmichael every bit as much as Martin Luther King.
SNCC. Oh, if you're talking about white liberals, yes, I'm talking about the attitudes towards race of other sorts of people.
Mark, you've described a kind of scheme in our recent politics of two, you call them dispensations, the Roosevelt dispensation and the Reagan dispensation. Is it your hope somehow to return to the Roosevelt dispensation, the idea that government exists to solve problems?
No, that can't be done because our situation is very different. To begin with, we've learned that the government can only do so much and that certain programs don't work, and we understand that better. The economic situation is completely different. We have a globalized economy. It's no longer possible to organize labor in the way we used to. Women are part of the workforce. All kinds of things have changed, but our basic principles, I think, haven't changed, and that is that we stick together. Citizens are not roadkill. We take care of each other. And secondly, that we stand for the equal protection under the law. And if we can only articulate what those two principles might mean in the present, I think we would be able to move on from our obsession with or our self-limitation to identity in order to reach out to people we haven't been able to reach out to.
Mark Lilla, thank you very much.
Okay, that was fun. Thanks.
Mark Lilla is a professor of humanities at Columbia University and the author of The Once and Future Liberal. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. On the next episode of the podcast, we'll take singer-songwriter Nick Lowe out for a cup of coffee, and we'll hear about the worst jobs of some of the best writers around. Hope you'll join us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Jessica Henderson and Sarah Sandbach. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.